Hello there, I'm Sophie Love and this is the Naked Farmers podcast where we get to strip bare real life stories and farmers and understand a bit more about how food and fibre are grown and raised in Australia. Now I'm sitting in my little tiny ex-cubby in the house paddock and it is actually raining. We are having drought breaking rain and the river is flowing, so I'm a bit overexcited, to be honest. And hopefully by the miracles of modern technology, today we get to meet Cameron Parker, a man who is on a mission to promote Australian agriculture. He's had an unconventional and interesting ag journey. And he's sitting in a hotel room somewhere in, where are you now, Cam?
Yeah, g'day, Sophie. I'm actually in Melbourne still at the moment, about to fly north. So, yeah, we'll learn a bit about that in a minute.
Most farmers are far removed from the supermarket shelves, but Cameron began his working life stacking shelves in suburban Melbourne. Cam, can you tell me a bit about where you grew up and your family of origin, please?
I grew up not too far from the Melbourne airport, actually, from where I'm sitting at the moment. Just northern suburbs of Melbourne, pretty stock standard middle class family. Dad went to work and mum stayed home and looking after two kids and lived in a little not quite a quarter acre block and went to school in the local area in the proper suburbs of Melbourne.
When did you leave school?
Finished high school, went through to the end of high school and did the what was called our VCE certificate then and got out of that, and as you do when you finish high school, look for a part-time job.
And so what was your first job out of school?
My first job out of school, like a lot of people knock on the door of the local supermarket and say, hey, do you have any jobs going at the moment? And I'm happy to do basically anything. At that time, the job they threw me was turn up at 10 o'clock at night and we'll have a whole heap of pallets of stock to put on the shelf, and by about 6 o'clock in the morning you can knock off. So I did that for good number of years when I first finished up school.
And did you work your way up the ranks in the supermarket, or was that just like a part-time job?
Yeah, so I was actually studying at uni at the time, and that was the idea, just a bit of a part-time gig. But I think when you try and work particularly hard and earn a bit too many penalty rates overnight, most companies try and make the most of anyone who's a bit keen on the gig, and they offered me a trainee manager position pretty young and a nice little salary that was pretty attractive to a 19-year-old. So that's how I ended up on a bit of a management training train, I suppose, that led to an eight and a half year career in Woolworths and climbing the corporate tree as you go, and going through a heap of different positions and different departments, and yeah, really enjoyed my time there.
Then what happened?
The story, as it's told now, on that management, progression, I put my hand up for a country move, which is somewhere where other people may not be as willing to go. So I ended up moving to Northern Victoria, taking on a higher management position there, and involved myself in that local community. So while I was up there, I particularly ended up doing a lot of farm work, whether it be on the weekends or even after work sometimes. I remember working in a chicken broiler shed, so somewhere where small chicks are raised to larger hens, so that the likes of my employer at the time, large supermarkets, could have roast chooks and all that kind of thing. I was able to have a bit of a part-time after-work gig there, helping out in those sheds, and just getting to know what everyone was doing around the area. It really fascinated me, I suppose.
So was that your first exposure to farms and farmers and ag?
My family do have farming roots in the Wimmera, grain farming connections. A number of my relatives out there have operations, but it's certainly far removed from my existence. And that was basically a Christmas time little holiday experience. You go and have a quick look at your uncle's farm or great uncle's farm as it was at the time. So did a bit of that. But when I had the opportunity to actually see how these guys were living in the location that I was in at the time in Northern Victoria, and really understanding what their passions were and what they enjoyed doing on the land, that really sparked a bit of an interest, I suppose. So that's where, even when I took annual leave or holidays or weekends, I'd oftentimes end up saying, oh, well, if you got work to do or whatever, let me give you a hand, and if you pay me well and good, but I'm more than happy to run you around or jump on a tractor for a while and just experience something totally different.
Was it a bit like a penny dropping moment, or almost a sort of spiritual moment when you sort of felt like you'd found your place?
So to move from retail management and in that corporate world, which is basically sitting inside a tin shed with no windows, to all of a sudden you might have a window pretty close to your face in a tractor, but the view you can see is just absolutely far beyond anything else I'd experienced at the time. Seeing what was actually able to be achieved from that tractor window, I suppose, was something that opened my eyes up to possibilities. And the fact that all these guys were having a real go and being progressive and excited about the future of their industry gave me the confidence that, hey, there might actually be something in this. I enjoyed my role, and I enjoyed working with a lot with the people that I worked with in Northern Victoria. The stresses of that world, yeah, were taking a toll on me, and I could see an outlet in the farming world, I suppose. And I ended up landing a full-time hay and harvest job 1 year, and that ended up turning into a full-time gig for nearly 5 years by the time I finished working with them.
I'm definitely a rebel, and I feel like there's a lot of farmers who their thoughts and their feelings and they're quite hard to contain. They're quite hard to put in a box, and that's one of the reasons why I want to do this podcast, because, you know, we see this rhetoric coming from cities about who and what farmers are, and that's my experience is you can't put them in boxes. They're so individualistic. And so for me, there's a sense of incredible freedom in being alone on a tractor, and also I get such a sense of satisfaction from something that someone else might see as being so mundane and boring, going round and round in circles. And sometimes it does feel like going round and round in circles, because it is. But, you know, I can see where I've been. Like, for me, that is so gratifying and satisfying. Was it like that for you, or was it being out in the open air, or, you know, what? Talk to me about what it was that really sort of sang to you.
I'll be slightly cheeky, Sophie, and pull you up on the round and round in circles thing. Nowadays we've got GPS guidance on our tractors and computer-controlled steering, so we go up and back in nice straight lines now. It's quite good like that.
My tractor doesn't have any of those things. My tractor is a very basic open-air model with no mod cons, I can assure you.
Different scale of things demands different technology, I think, Sophie, and... For your small plot there, I think the most efficient and most economic way of farming your place would be using your equipment. And the exciting thing I find about modern agriculture in the broader scale, which is the industry I'm mainly got my experience in, is actually utilising the latest technology so that we can be more efficient and more economically viable with what we do.
I'm on a small farm, very small farm by Australian standards, and we're a grazing property, not a cropping property. So cropping and haymaking and all those things are not things that I have direct experience of, except for on a very small scale. So can you talk to me about the tech and the scope and the scale of what you were doing in Northern Victoria, please?
Yeah, so in Northern Victoria I was... involved in and had my own small operation in growing crops for grain predominantly. That's my passion, growing things from little seeds. So in actual answer to your question just before, my passion and interest really came from we're putting these tiny little things in the ground, and over a year, only after over 6 months a lot of times, I can actually see them be planted, germinate, grow and develop, and we can manage those crops to a point where we can actually have a harvest of whether it be hay, which for fodder or to feed livestock, or an actual grain product, which the end user has the choice of what they do with it too. So they can mill that or develop that for human consumption, or they can also feed livestock with that production as well. But the point being, I put one single seed in the ground in one particular spot, and 6 or 7 months later, I can come back and return a large amount of fodder or 100, 200 times the grain yield. And that's something that really excited me from an outsider coming into the industry. We grew cereal crops and some legume crops, so wheat, barley, and oats for cereals. So they're all plants that come from plants that look like grass, and they are a form of grass. Then we had different crops with a broader leaf, which are more about a vetch. So vetch is a bit of a herb. So we grow a nice bushy herb and cut that, and then dairy cows and other livestock love to eat that. It's a very high protein feed source. And we also grew canola, which is used for cooking oil, very small little seed, a bit like a mustard seed, and also previously grown lentils and chickpeas, which are legume crops and grain crops that we Indian and Asian customers like to use. But I also like to cook with lentils for my pea and lentil soup, and I quite like a bit of hummus dip in my cheese board too, so it's quite nice when you can use your own chickpeas for that.
Let's just drill into this a little bit. What size sort of paddocks, what scope are we talking? And then how do you make the decision what to grow at any point in the year, and looking at the forecasting and all that sort of thing? So how do you make those decisions? How do you decide what's going to be the most profitable? How do you decide what's going to be the best for the soil? How do you decide what's going to need the least input?
So I think the key thing to understand from an outsider's point of view now is a grain farmer and a hay farmer, or any farmer in Australia, they're no longer just a tractor driver or just a dairy manager. Every day we've got choices around, we've got marketing, so you've got to look at the broader market for the commodity you want to grow. For my scenario, it was a wheat and barley that we wanted to go through to grain, but if the prices weren't there for the grain product, we had the option to cut it for hay, so then we can decide, is the hay market going to be there? Are there going to be producers who are willing to pay the right price for us to turn that into hay? We've also got, like you were saying, soil management. So our soil is the number one thing that we need to look after so that we can be not just profitable but actually viable into the future. If we absolutely ruin the soil that we have on our individual farms, or we mismanage it, then that will show up very, very quickly within a number of years, and it'll degrade the future crops that we're attempting to grow. So whether it be marketing, soil management, or just straight up financial management on the scale of money involved and capital involved to be able to plant, manage, and harvest a crop. Today's farmer is simply not just sitting on a tractor seat. The couple of things you were asking there was around paddock size. So, where possible, realistically, we need the biggest paddocks we can possibly either A, obtain, or B, manage. So, we need to be able to manage the variability across the country. So, whether we have better performing or worse performing soils, we need to be able to manage our inputs for that. If there's a need for more fertilizer in one place than another, it's much better to spend money and spend fertilizer in one particular spot versus another, because if it's not going to be used, then there's an environmental risk there. So we like to minimize where possible any environmental risk, but also any expenditure that we don't need. So we need the biggest paddocks that we can manage. which sometimes are a normal paddock in northern Victoria where it was around the 100 hectare mark, which is 250 acres in the old language, up to the biggest paddocks we managed were 800-900 hectares plus. For everybody listening at home, a nice little analogy, I suppose, is the Melbourne CBD, which the City Loop tram goes around. You can have a look at a map one day. The nice square block rectangular block that the City Loop tram goes around, that's around about the 240 hectare mark, about the 600 acres or thereabouts. So there's a bit of scale going on, and it's pretty cool to be operating machinery in such a big wide open space.
I'm interested that you talk about soil viability and soil management and fertilizer. There's a lot of controversy about fertilizer, particularly obviously between the organic style farmers and the biodynamic style farmers say that NPK fertilizer is actually robbing the soil. But it's a bit like dyeing your hair. It's like, yes, it gives you a quick lift and it looks good for a certain amount of time, and then you're going to have to keep doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. And whereas the organic and biodynamic farmers would say what you want to be doing is like adding humus to the soil. And there seems to me that these two very different styles of farming are actually coming to meet in the middle, which I'm really passionate about that. No-till farming. So can you just speak to that, any of that, quite frankly, because that's quite a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot wrapped up in that, Sophie, but I think the thing for me is that it comes back to, though, is regardless of our farming systems, everybody is ideally looking towards the future. So we're not just looking to get this year's crop, and we're not just looking even to get next year's crop. It's all around looking after our soil in which we grow our plants to be able to be profitably and sustainably producing food and fiber 5, 10, 15 years into the future. So I'm not going to necessarily comment on each individual system. However, more and more of the science is coming out saying the more that we don't disturb our soil and different forms of nutrients and fertilizer that we can apply to our crops, it's quickly becoming an economic decision to say, if we don't have to overapply and we have the options and the technology to vary how much we apply where, then that's an excellent way to reduce both our environmental impact, but also at the end of the day, our economic impact on our businesses too. So everybody is all about doing the right thing for both the environment and also the sustainability of our businesses going forward.
This is where, on this podcast, I get to ask questions about how I'm impacted personally. So at the moment, I mean, obviously we're experiencing at the moment, which is potentially drought-breaking rain. So please God, everybody is getting it. And please God, this foul, horrible, brutal drought is over. But we've been paying an absolute fortune for hay, a lot of it coming out of Victoria. And I just wonder, it's a really hard dichotomy, this, and I don't really know how to phrase this question, because I more than anybody want farmers to make a profit, and not just that, but get well paid for what they do, because I know how bloody hard we all work. But on the other hand, I don't want to be the farmer who's going into debt to pay the other farmer a good price. So that's kind of a really hard place to be in for both the seller and the buyer. What do you make of that?
It's a challenging situation anytime, Sophie, when you've got either one end of the production market having a really good win, or more so when there's just absolute rock bottom prices. So it's very easy as an agricultural industry to actually be saying, oh, you know, Peter over there, they're trying to rob Paul and vice versa all the time. But at the end of the day, what we're all doing as primary producers is producing food and fibre for a broader market. So the interesting thing you're picking up here is that oftentimes one primary producer will sell to another, but then that producer will end up producing food or fibre for a broader community market. I'm no economist, and I'm certainly not a marketing expert whatsoever, but at the end of the day, what it actually comes down to for me is the old supply and demand thing, but also you've got within the ag industry in Australia, there's a fantastic rapport amongst regular customers. So, and between customers. So I know plenty of people across the industry at the moment who are selling hay to their regular clients, clients who will buy hundreds of tons of hay every year, year in, year out, whether it's a thumping drought or whether it's the best production season anybody's seen. There's that relationship and rapport that's been developed over many years, or even in development as we speak. But there's that rapport there between the producer and the client within the ag industry, and they're selling hay well below what would be quoted as market rate. Yes, unfortunately, there is going to be a case that there's hay available for a very high price. But at the same time, if there's the demand for that hay at that price, today's modern society, we cannot deny anybody the opportunity to sell and essentially buy hay at what we think is a high price. The buyer would hopefully be doing their sums as well, and it's a case where that hay is required to be able to grow their next product onto a much higher value product themselves. So as a beef cattle producer, if you're going to be buying in hay at a very high price, then you'd be hoping, and not even hoping, you would know that your beef or your animal coming up in the next 9, 10, 12 months will be worth a lot more, purely because you've kept your animal alive and you've put better condition on them and you're looking after your product, than if you hadn't have bought that hay. Then you'd have the decision that you'd have to sell in the current market. So the fact that the hay prices is going up basically says to me that there's a shortage of hay, but also there's a demand within the market saying the commodities that hay is going to support, that's going to increase also. So that's an individual business decision for every party along the line. In particular times of pinch points, whether it be droughts, fire, flooding rains, anything under the sun like that, or whether it be, as was a couple of years ago, a chronic shortage of hay produced. There was very little hay produced a few years ago, yet the demand was high. So prices are obviously going to rise on a supply and demand scale. It's very difficult, especially when we know our customers so well and we know there's a hurt right across the supply chain. But at the moment, it's a case of every business has their own decisions to make and their own risk profile that they're willing to take.
I love the fact that you've talked about how skilled and multifaceted the modern farmer is, and how much information and risk they have to juggle. So obviously they're not commodity traders. I mean, some of them might be.
I'll jump in there, Sophie, for a minute. Whether they're full-time skilled commodity traders isn't necessarily the point. It's actually the fact that all farmers, regardless what they produce, have an idea, have a concept, or
contract employ somebody to tell them what that commodity is doing going forward, because we don't want to produce something that the world doesn't want. We don't want to produce something that won't push our farms and won't help our farms be sustainable into the future. Yeah, there's no point growing something that nobody wants. There is a point where we may not be professional commodity traders, but we absolutely have a finger in the pie. We absolutely need to understand, on a broad level, that yes, this is what we're producing, this is what it may go to.
So when the farmer or the contractor or the manager is making the decision what to sow, what to grow, you're juggling long-range weather forecasting, you're juggling and looking at commodity prices, so whether India is looking for lentils or whether China is looking for chickpeas or whether there's a big demand for the animal feed market, for sorghum or whatever it is. So those are the factors that you're looking at, as well as obviously your soil profile, what you think your paddock or paddocks can grow, whether you have irrigation, whether you don't. Like, so it seems like it's such a multifactorial decision-making process. And I know you're really into ag tech. So tell me, what tools do you use to make some of those decisions?
The answer to that, Sophie, is really every tool under the sun is available. There's more and more coming out, and to the point where it's almost confusing for some people. But the beauty of that is that we have the opportunity now to utilize those tools to enable our businesses to be the best they can be. So I've got the ability to look through paddock history and yield data and understand how that square meter of soil has performed throughout 8, 9, 10 years. I've got the ability to go through that data and actually say, okay, that particular square meter there, that's going to be good going forward for whatever crop and whatever conditions. So if I can put all those square meters through a 100 hectares, 1,000 hectares of paddock, there's millions of these square meters, and I can put that through a computer system which will now tell me the possibilities that are available in that paddock. So it won't give me a exact answer to say you are much better to plant wheat here than barley versus chickpeas, but I can see the paddock history has had a number of years of wheat or a number of years of chickpeas. So we like to rotate those crops through so that we can avoid disease, we can avoid particular weeds that will enjoy a particular environment. So if we grow wheat on wheat on wheat every year, there'll be particular weeds that will just thrive in that environment. We've got no chance of controlling them. So we'll plant chickpeas instead. Or in Victoria, we plant canola or lentils. We've got those options to change what we grow when we grow it. But as you were just saying before, there's no point growing something just for the sake of it. So that's where, particularly in Victoria, I really enjoyed the fact that we could grow a crop up until about August, especially something along the lines of barley. And we had the decision that if there was no barley grain market, we had the option to cut it for hay and feed into a livestock market, or vice versa. If all the dairy producers in Victoria were having a fantastic year, and let's hope that happens for them coming up this year, because they certainly could do with a bit of a kick along. We had the option to say, look, there's not much of a cereal barley hay market at the moment, so let's run that through the grain. And that's something we can store on farm a lot easier in a silo and send it out to China for their requirements as they call for it later on in the year. so many decision points along the line, which actually gives a fair amount of flexibility, which is something I particularly love about this industry, Sophie.
Is there someone that a farmer or a contractor like trusts to work with that they're buying seed from or then selling seed to? So how does that work? Because obviously you're not just making those decisions about what to grow, but you've also then got to sell the stuff. So you've got to buy the seed from somewhere and then sell the stuff. Talk to me, how does that work?
Rural country towns nowadays have a number of professionals within them, as well as primary producers, and that's actually pretty exciting for the future of country communities and our rural lifestyle outside of the major centres. So we've got agronomists on the ground. So they're people who actually assist us with identifying issues within our crop, particularly, and to a certain degree our soils as well. So these are very highly skilled people who farmers can employ, whether that be on a contract basis or ad hoc basis, to say, hey, John, can you come out and have a look at my wheat crop and just tell me about it? You know, is it progressing well? Does it need any particular management? Are the weeds getting too bad in it? What's the story? So you've got the agronomists there that do a lot of the scientific analysis within the crop. It's almost like a bit of a doctor, really. So you call on the doctor to say, hey, I'm feeling a bit crook at the moment. Do I need something to give me a bit of a pep up? And that's exactly what the agronomist does for us. Before we plant something, we'd be probably talking to a grain broker or a grain trader that you've got a relationship with, saying, look, you know, what's the market up to at the moment? That's their job. Traders and brokers and grain analysts, they all do a slightly different thing, but at the end of the day, they know the grain market. They're the ones that farmers and at the end of the day, end customers also employ to say, all right, what's the market looking like in 7 months? Because I'm going to put a seed in the ground now. I want it to be worth something at the other end. So that's their job. That they look at the Chicago Board of Trade and all these different algorithms and indices that are, to me, particularly boring, but that's their job, and they do a very good job of it. You're also asking about seed supplies and other merchandise as well. And look, that's one of the good things about local towns and local centres that we need to support and keep viable, because they are the backbone of a lot of rural industries. So we've got places where we can go, like you say, purchase seed, but also purchase different crop protection products so that we can keep our crops healthy and keep weeds at bay. And we've got people employed in a number of industries, a number of businesses, that support all that activity. So really great industry to be involved in that supports a lot of people right across the community, not just on the farm driving the tractor or scratching in soil to work something out. There's plenty of people involved all across the board.
All gamblers by nature, I think, honestly.
At the end of the day, Sophie, if it doesn't rain, there's no production, or there's much, much limited production. So it still comes down to, though, those decision points. So if we plant a crop, if we've got enough moisture to plant a crop and we can produce something, there's oftentimes an option that we can market that product. So that's something that I'm particularly keen on and particularly excited about with ag, where even in a drought, providing we can grow something, which granted a lot of areas this year have not been able to grow a single thing, and that's particularly where it gets very difficult, particularly heart-wrenching for a lot of producers, because we are producers by nature. But if we can get something out of the ground, we can often produce, whether it be a bit of fodder or even so a hay crop, which won't progress to grain, but we can cut that particular biomass for that particular plant matter for hay, or it's a case of working with livestock producers too. So we've had some particularly horrendous crops, but we're able to work in with livestock producers in the area and come to particular adjustment arrangements where livestock producers with no feed on their their property can come and pay us a fee to tidy up our failed crops too. So it's all about that working in together factor as well, producing food and fibre for not just Australia but the world.
How did you get to go from the fertile green paddocks of Victoria to Queensland?
I ended up in central Queensland, just south of Emerald there, actually. That's actually through that broader network of farmers that I've sort of been talking about a little bit with, you know, within your district and knowing those around you. But one of the things I really, really enjoy about Australian agriculture is the camaraderie and identification with each other on a much broader scale. So I'm a prolific Twitter user myself, so I've got to know a number of producers in different industries and different locations through that, but also particular industry programs and opportunities, so via representation groups. So yeah, I got to know a particular fella through a leadership program that I did, and yeah, there was an opportunity to head up and give him a hand for a while. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed the opportunity to go see their production system and go see how they grow grain and their particular weather challenges and soil constraints that they've got up there. So yeah, I really enjoyed that experience.
That's very different country, not that I've been there, as I understand it, from Victoria. So can you paint me a bit of a picture of life up there, the landscape, the views, and what the ebb and flow of your working life was with the different seasons?
It's very different in the fact that it's larger scale production. There's mountain ranges on 3.5, nearly 4 sides of where I could see from my house, on that particular property, and just the undulating land flow was something totally different to the very flat plains of northern Victoria that I was used to. But at the end of the day, the actual soil types were remarkably similar. The very fascinating thing for me in central Queensland is all about the opportunities when it rains and having the flexibility and the agility within your system and within the farming business to be able to take hold of any opportunity that the rain gives you. We were growing winter crops at the time and they were grown on absolutely minimal in-crop rainfall. So from the time the seeds were planted to when we harvested them, there was less than 50 millimetres of rainfall in between. However, there was a larger rainfall event through March. So that gave us the ability to utilise moisture stored in the soil. So utilising every drop of rain that does fall, maximising the production from that rainfall, whether you store it in the soil through good management of the soil or whether it be in-crop rainfall after the seed's planted. It's just the ability to manage your farm and your business so that you can capitalise on that when it happens. And, it's just absolutely fascinating to see the different ways that right across Australia we can grow grain, fodder and fibre.
The paddock size would be a bit different, presumably, in central Queensland to Victoria.
Well and truly, yes. So the biggest aggregation of paddocks ended up being around about the 1,100 hectare mark, which is quite sizable and comes with its own challenges. But at the same time, it's actually just about different scales that are required to do things economically.
How do farmers manage? Because this equipment, especially the kind of tech equipment that you're talking about, costs an awful lot of money, doesn't it?
The capital required to access a lot of technology, access a lot of, the latest and greatest machinery, it's enormous. However, it's all about finding that balance, like you were saying, around utilising technology to save money in the production phase, or do you spend more money in the production phase because you can't access the technology. So it's absolute balance, which is where the economies of scale do come in. So if you're operating larger area, you can spread your technology, you can spread your machinery across more hectares so that that machinery can service that, that larger area. A lot of the places I was on in Victoria were using older gear to a certain level, but absolutely maximising that gear for the amount of hectares they were farming. And it's also about risk factor too. So if you've got an irrigation property where you know you can nearly lock in production year on year based on availability of water, you can forecast 5 years ahead that you've got access to water, you can invest in machinery and technology because you know you've got the production income to be able to repay that technology. However, if you're in an area where the production isn't as guaranteed, well, you run cheaper gear, potentially at a lower efficiency sometimes, but the risk profile is different. So it's all about understanding how much you want to put on the line and what the risk is one way or the other. If it's a risk of crop failure and no repayments, minimal money coming in so you can make your obligations bank-wise, or whether it's a case of a high upside, so higher rainfall, there's irrigation available, it's more fertile land, well, you make that decision based on the risk you want to take within your business.
Wow, Cam, I'm so impressed with your adaptability, resourcefulness and passion for ag. You embody that amazing have a go, do anything quality that I so admire in Australian farmers. So often when we're in those supermarkets, we don't think about where the raw ingredients have come from. That's what this podcast is all about, is about exposing the stories of those people. And you really have been learning on the hoof, which in my book is always the best way to learn anything. But that's because I didn't go to uni either. I say I went to the University of Life. I understand you're going to put that on the ground experience to really good use in a very different role. Talk to me about your next career move.
Yeah, so Sophie, over the last 5 years, I've been having different involvement in industry groups. Probably like yourself, people have been a little bit interested in my entry into farming and that sort of thing, and got to know quite a few people within the broader industry. So I've had a lot to do with grains representation groups and getting involved in how to help people like myself outside of the industry get into grain growing and primary production, and I've really enjoyed that sort of stuff on the side. A lot of that role there is actually helping advocate to, whether it be government or other people who affect primary producers, just advocating and talking to those people, saying, look, this is actually what would be really helpful. Either what you've currently got on the table, that's really good, thanks very much, but it's not really what we need right now. How about this? Or actually just going straight up and saying, look, we've got this need at the moment. People like myself who want to get into the industry, or other people currently in the industry, to really help us go forward and be the best that we can be, so that we can contribute to the broader community and the broader economy. This is the sort of thing that we might need. So whether that be different policy settings from government or local government particularly. So we've had a lot of things around the movement of freight from Victoria, for instance. So like you were saying, you're buying a lot of hay into New South Wales at the moment, and we were particularly working on getting 2 40-foot trailers of hay. Being able to get that from Victoria up into New South Wales was impossible a few years ago, but through a lot of the work that we've done, we're able to get that approved and get that over the line. Things like that really started to excite me, and see a few wins that we were able to have, and a bit of change and impact on farmers, impact for the better. Recently, a state farming organisation was advertising for a role that was able to contribute more in a full-time basis to that sort of work, and that's really what I'm going forward on now. So I've stepped off farm and gone to a capital city and be able to make a difference for farmers on the ground through my experience and through what I know, but also through analysing a lot of data that comes across my desk and a lot of information and suggestions that are made from different decision makers. Just to be able to contribute to that conversation and really, really make primary producers in my particular area more profitable and more sustainable for the future.
It's a huge and exciting change. I'm so excited to see ag organisations hiring real farmers. We need calm, clear voices who can cross the divide between city and farmers, and that is absolutely you, Cam. It's a big move, though. How are you going to cope being back in the city?
I haven't lived in a city. I think I worked out the other day for nearly half my life. Not quite, but I've nearly lived half my life in the country versus in the city. But I'm really looking forward to having the direct access to those who affect farmers with the decisions that they make. So the decision makers that affect farmers the most are in our capital cities, whether we like it or not. So I'm really looking forward to having close access to those people.
So you do see some opportunities that you'll be able to get some dirt back on your boots.
Absolutely. I haven't quite thrown out my Cobra and my new wardrobe in city apartment that I've got. Quite confused. It's got a range from full suit and tie gig right through. I've still got a number of work shirts with a bit of grease on them, so you never know when they might come out yet, Sophie.
Wow, you're going to have to wear clothes that don't have holes in them. That's like how are you going to cope with that?
Well, time will tell. Time will tell.
There's a fantastic thread on Twitter today, actually, about the clothes that we wear on farms. I'll tell you a little story, actually. When I first came here, the 80-year-old farmer, well, I suppose he was in his mid-70s then, who actually did all our tractor work for the first year, all his clothes had holes in them. And I felt really sorry for him, and I thought he was really poor. So I bought him this beautiful jumper to wear in the winter. And, of course, he never wore it because it was way too good for the farm. And now I'm like him. Like all my jumpers have holes in them, all my T-shirts, everything. So it's not that I was casting shade on you, Cam, as like wearing particularly badly dressed on farm, just that we all wear clothes to their last moment in time on the farm.
The adaptability of the modern farmer could be portrayed in their wardrobe. For me, wearing baggy old clothes or clothes with still a bit of grease on them and a bit of holes in them on farm is very, very freeing and very almost relaxing, I suppose, even though a lot of the work that we do is quite physically intensive. It actually says something about the modern farmer that the modern farmer and the modern agricultural professional is actually quite diverse in their abilities. So the ability to put on those work jeans and really hook in and have a go, and the ability to put on a nice shirt and go talk to the bank manager or the politician. The modern farmer is just as capable in a suit and tie as they are in their work gear, even though they may be more comfortable in their work gear.
Oh, I think that's such a wonderful point. It's so true that the modern farmers are just as at home in a suit and tie as they are in their daggy old dacks and battered a Cobra on the tractor or fencing or whatever. I really love that portrayal, actually, of the modern farmer. Thank you for that, Cam. I know you're going to be fantastic in this new role. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you today. I feel like everything you've learned and everything you've experienced is going to lend credence to your communications on both sides of the fence, as it were. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been amazing.
That's been great, Soph. Thanks for the invitation, and thanks for everyone for listening.
If you've liked this episode, tell your friends about the Naked Farmers podcast and help them to subscribe if that means taking their phone off them and showing them a podcasting app so they can get on board. That would be great. You can rate and review us in Apple Podcasts, and that really helps other people find us. If your podcasting app does allow reviewing or rating, please do that and help us grow. Thanks so much for joining us today as we explore the facts and some of the figures about Aussie Ag and meet the people who grow our food and shape food policy. I really appreciate you joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Cam Parker. He's a great guy and I'm excited about his future and his influence on ag policy in this country. Thanks for joining us and spread the word.